The Guardian.
This podcast is sponsored by audible.co.uk, the number one online destination for digital audiobooks.
The Guardian Poetry Podcast.
I'm Imtiaz Dharkar, and I'm going to read you the Elizabeth Bishop poem, One Art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing further, losing faster, places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster. I like this poem for the way it starts quite innocently and pleasantly, almost as if a joke's being made, with the tone cool and light and situations that seem amusing, like the fluster of lost door keys. But the losses grow, the mother's watch, houses, cities, rivers, a continent. All of these are dismissed casually. It wasn't a disaster. The poem's a villanelle with the first and third lines alternating at the end of the following stanzas. And to me, this form has always felt like a dance where you know you'll come back to square one at the end. It's not a form I like particularly, but Elizabeth Bishop uses it in a devastating way, as Dylan Thomas did and in Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night, and Sylvia Plath did later in Mad Girl's Love Song. But in this poem, I have the sense of it gambling along until it moves into more and more dangerous territory. This harmless-looking villanelle turns treacherous and pushes the reader into the jaws of the inevitable last word, disaster. Elizabeth Bishop is using the tyranny of the form to bring us face to face with the final loss. Losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love. This is genius, to pretend lightness. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, and use it to come face to face with the tragedy, without self-pity. The command breaks forcefully into the last line, though it may look like, write it, like disaster. The word like is stammered out as if the poet's stumbling over the final word, disaster. So here she's using an extremely strict form of art, extreme artifice, to force herself to confront the enormity of loss. This becomes a poem about how art is used to face loss and how a poet can write grief. I've always admired the poem, but recently I came to writing about loss myself, or not writing it, or not being able to write. And now I appreciate even more what she's saying and the skill, the art she uses to say it. Loss is impossible to deal with, and in some cases there may be no redemption, but all the writer can do is to confront grief on the page and follow the command and write it.
Thank you.
And I'm going to read Meeting Point by Louis McNeice. Time was away and somewhere else. There were two glasses and two chairs and two people with the one pulse. Someone stopped the moving stairs. Time was away and somewhere else. And they were neither up nor down. The stream's music did not stop flowing through heather, limpid brown, although they sat in a coffee shop. And they were neither up nor down. The bell was silent in the air, holding its inverted poise between the clang and clang, a flower, a brazen calyx of no noise. The bell was silent in the air. The camels crossed the miles of sand that stretched around the cups and plates. The desert was their own. They planned to portion out the stars and dates. The camels crossed the miles of sand. Time was away and somewhere else. The waiter did not come. The clock forgot them, and the radio waltz came out like water from a rock. Time was away and somewhere else. Her fingers flicked away the ash that bloomed again in tropic trees, not caring if the markets crash when they had forests such as these. Her fingers flicked away the ash. God, or whatever means the good, be praised that time can stop like this, that what the heart has understood can verify in the body's peace, God, or whatever means the good. Time was away, and she was here, and life no longer what it was. The bell was silent in the air, and all the room one glow because time was away, and she was here. The thing I've always loved about this poem is that it's a film on a page. Just start with the image of the two people sitting at a cafe table. The two are viewed from outside in the third person. And the usual game would be to invent their backstory. But at this meeting point, time's been banished out of the frame. The poem makes a space for them outside of time. Somebody stopped the moving stair, the escalator, the stairway to heaven. In this poem, they're immortal. Mythical. So much great poetry about love and death is really poetry about time, stopping time, looking back in time, longing for a moment in the past or future, like John Donne's Busy Old Fool, Unruly Son, Why Dost Thou Thus Through Windows and Through Curtains Call on Us, and of course Auden's Stop All the Clocks. McNeice manages to freeze the motion as if it were one of those moments on film where the main characters are still and intensely focused while time and space change and transform around them. It's a huge double exposure, a desert stretching around the cups and plates complete with camels. The world becomes vast and exotic. Ordinary things are mentioned, markets crash, the waiter does not come, but nothing stays ordinary here. Her throwaway gesture becomes eternal. The ash flicked from her cigarette blooms as a tropical forest. Even silence blossoms between the clang and clang, a flower. All the everyday things, tables, chairs, glasses, become charged with meaning and passion. It's as if the image is under a spell, heightened by magic numbers, 2, 2, 1, the incantation of the first and last line of every verse. No one says the word love. Hands don't even have to touch. But this is high romance in a public place. It's a Casablanca of a poem. Yashwant Rao. by Arun Kolatkar. Are you looking for a god? I know a good one. His name is Yashwant Rao, and he's one of the best. Look him up when you're in Jejuri next. Of course, he's only a second-class god, and his place is just outside the main temple, outside even of the outer wall, as if he belonged among the tradesmen and the lepers. I've known gods prettier-faced or straighter-laced, gods who soak you for your gold, gods who soak you for your soul, gods who make you walk on a bed of burning coal, gods who put a child inside your wife or a knife inside your enemy, gods who tell you how to live your life, double your money or triple your land holdings, gods who can barely suppress a smile as you crawl a mile for them, gods who will see you drown if you won't buy them a new crown. And although I'm sure they're all to be praised, they're either too symmetrical or too theatrical for my taste. Yashwant Rao, mass of basalt, bright as any postbox, the shape of protoplasm or king-size lava pie thrown against a wall, without an arm, a leg, or even a single head. Yashwant Rao, he's the god you've got to meet. If you're short of a limb, Yashwant Rao will lend you a hand and get you back on your feet. Yashwant Rao does nothing spectacular. He doesn't promise you the earth or book your seat on the next rocket to heaven. But if any bones are broken, you know he'll mend them. He'll make you whole in your body and hope your spirit will look after itself. He is merely a kind of bone setter. The only thing is, as he himself has no heads, hands and feet, he happens to understand you a little better. This poem's from a sequence set in Jejuri, a pilgrimage site in the hills of Maharashtra in India. And commerce and holiness cross paths quite comfortably in this place. There's nothing reverential in the tone of the poem. The voice isn't of a pilgrim, but more a tourist. In a place crammed full of gods, he's recommending this one as if he were sharing top travel tips with a lost fellow traveller about a good cafe or a decent place to stay. Are you looking for a god? I know a good one. So this isn't a five-star god, resplendent and many-headed, but a second-class god, without an arm, a leg, or even a single head. The poet turns this into an advantage. This is a low-caste street god, ideally equipped to understand the broken and the misshapen. In Kolatkar's Jejuri, all kinds of deals are struck, and this is spiritual bargaining at its Indian best. Yashwant Rao can't quite be pinned down or given a precise form, very much like the poet himself. Arun Kolatkar was completely bilingual and wrote fluently in Marathi as well as English, and you can hear that, I think, in the poem. Perhaps the idiom he used was more American than English. As he told his editor, Arvind Krishna Mehrotra, he was influenced not just by Marathi, Sanskrit and the Bhakti poets, but also by all kinds of international writers, as well as gangster films, cartoon strips, the blues, Black American speech. It influenced my poems in that I realized suddenly that I could use all the influences that I had as well and bring those into the poems and into the language of the poems. Because when I first read this in Bombay in the 70s, I felt he'd used a language different from the poetry I'd heard till then. It was spare and stripped down to the bare bones, as if the poem had come off the street and struck up a conversation with me. There's nothing in this that can't be translated or thought in other tongues.
Visit audible.co.uk/guardianaudio to choose from a selection of over 60,000 titles. With Audible, you can make more time for books by downloading and listening wherever you are and whatever you're doing.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.